Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we will meet Milford painter C. Mercedes Walls. We'll hear a story about slavery on Delmarva, and Dave Wilson will bring us a conversation about box turtles. Milford artist C. Mercedes Walls, also known as Kathy Walls, creates bright, joyful paintings in a style that is both representational and expressionistic. Kathy comes from a large family of six children. Her grandmother's family were opera singers, and her grandfather was a shoe designer who encouraged her artistic talents as a youngster. After college, Kathy had a career as a probation and parole officer for the Delaware Division of Corrections. But Kathy has painted throughout her life without much formal training.
And I always painted on the side because, you know, just for extra money and whatever, little commissions, you know, portraits of people's houses, pets, that sort of thing, Christmas presents. And then when we decided to have a third child, I said, well, you know, I can't keep working with three kids because it was about a 50-hour week plus the commute up to Dover. So I just quit and opened up my studio and thought I'd really miss it, but never looked back. I really enjoyed it. Felt real guilty having so much fun working. I kind of get an idea what I want to earn for the year. And then I try to work from there so that I don't spend too much time. I think it was Monet who had said it takes two people to do a painting, one to paint and one to say stop. So my husband's really good at saying, I need to spend enough time on that. So I try to pace myself so I can earn what I need to earn. As far as going out, and I use social media a lot to get that word out that I'm available for commissions. A lot of it is word of mouth. Somebody will get something done and they'll let somebody know and they'll come to me too. And that seems to keep me pretty busy at times. Now, during the recession, things dropped off the map. I had very little work, very few commissions, and because I rely on commissions and not galleries, I was at a disadvantage. But things have picked up a lot now. So I think that I've often said that artists are the canaries in the economic coal mine. We're the first ones to feel the pain, to feel that things are going bad. But the good news is, I feel like things are probably at a better level than they were even before the recession.
Kathy uses a large collection of her snapshot photography as her subject matter. She also uses Photoshop on her computer to compile and compose painting layouts. But she relies on the tried and true methods artists have long employed to maintain and grow her technique.
I sketch a lot. Sketch, like, pretty much if I'm just sitting there, like I said, I'm a doodler, just sitting around, I've always got a pencil or something in my hand. To do my compositions, of course, the first thing is to get that picture down there. I also have a group that meets first Thursday of every month at the Art League. We bring a model in so people can, and that's good for me because it's kind of selfish that I really want to keep that going because it gives me an opportunity to have a live model to practice with every now and then because it's kind of hard to get people to sit still for you. So, Yeah, it's a drawing is a big part of what I enjoy doing.
Kathy arrived at her own style simply by trial and error, since she has had relatively little formal art training. She's tried a variety of mediums over the years, depending on what commissions called for. She says that she currently does equal portions of pastels, watercolors, and oils. Her color palette tends towards hues that are true to life, but fairly bright and saturated. This gives the work an upbeat, light feeling with storytelling at its core.
Working in probation parole gave me an opportunity to work with people, doing my paintings and being able to now do my own subject matter and being able to paint scenes with people. In that sense, they're related. I think it's just I've always been interested in people, and I'm kind of an extrovert. I guess a lot of artists tend to be introverts, and I'm kind of the opposite. I kind of thrive on human contact and human interaction. I like the scenes of the kids playing with the dogs, or, you know, that people singing. I really love scenes of musicians. I've got a series of paintings that I'm slowly working on because I keep getting distracted by life. But I haven't thought of an official name for it, but basically it's professions. It's people on their job. I had visited one of the crab houses, and the women were all there picking these huge mountains of crabs. And I thought, this is a job that's probably going to disappear, because they already have invented machines that are picking these crabs. So I want to do a painting of these women doing this hard work, you know, and the farmers in the field. I've done paintings of that. But as careers are starting to disappear, I want to kind of document them. My genre scenes are sometimes intentionally showing, you know, this is life in this location, or this is what it's really like. And I like to represent what's around me. I like to represent my community. So I'm a white person, but my subject matter isn't always white, because we live in a fairly diverse community here. I want people to know that, and to know we live in a diverse little community here in Milford. So my subject matter, I hope, reflects that. I really like this little town. I grew up in cities and suburbs, and of course I've been here for 40 years almost, so I've been in the country longer than I've been in the city in my life, but I just love this little town because it is diverse and people do care, and it's a great volunteer town, which has helped the Art League. A lot of what we do at the Art League is to try to reach out to the families in the community and bring them something to kind of enrich their lives.
Kathy teaches classes to students of all ages and abilities and encourages anyone interested in art to make it a part of their daily lives.
The biggest thing is to try new things, to do something every day, whether it's just scribbling on a piece of paper or carry a little paint box around and just, I mean, even if you just paint your breakfast cereal, you know, just do whatever you're doing, just do something every day, because the more you do, the better you get. Sign up for little classes if you can take them, paint with somebody who does paint. But just expose yourself to it. Visit the museum, see what the masters were doing. But you have to immerse, it's like learning a foreign language. You have to immerse yourself into it and just really enjoy it and get into it. Artists should also be advocates for the art. I think it's fine to be in your world and do your painting and do what you enjoy it and paint or write music or write books or poetry for the sake of that. But go out and see other people's art too. Spread the word. Bring a friend to a show. Go to a poetry reading. You know, bring a friend to a poetry. Go out there and enjoy all the arts. Don't get stuck in your studio or at your computer or whatever. Just get out there and advocate and show people art and go see a lot of it yourself.
Visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts, to see a video of this interview, get a link to her website, and see samples of her work. You can see Kathy Wall's painting in person at the Miss Pillion Art League in Milford, Delaware, where their current show running through November 12th is called A Harvest of Art. While you're in Milford, enjoy strolling through that picturesque historic downtown nestled on the banks of the Missipillion River, and see the Art on the Riverwalk tour of small decorated boats. If you're looking for some refreshment, you'll find gourmet coffee and award-winning restaurants. It's time for our first break now. When we come back, we'll hear a story about slavery on Delmarva. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe. Racial conflict continues to be a big part of our public discourse. It's hard to deny that our heritage of state-sanctioned slavery is at the root of these tensions. The early beginnings of the African slave trade on Delmarva can be traced to the New Sweden colony of present-day Delaware in the early 1620s, when the Dutch West Indies Company promised colonists there would be slave labor to help them make their fortunes in the New World. It took almost 2 decades for them to make good on that promise, and they began with just one slave. In 1638, they sent ships, the Kalmar Nickel and the Gripen, to the Caribbean for a trading expedition. The leader of the mission was Peter Minuit, who was famous for purchasing Manhattan Island from the native peoples there. This trip was his undoing. While anchored at the island of St. Christina, Minuit was visiting a Dutch ship called the Flying Deer when a hurricane devastated many of the boats in the harbor, killing Minuit. The Kalmar Nickel returned to Europe. The Gripen made its way back to the New Sweden colony, bringing with them one Negro slave named Anthony. This was the first recorded slave in what is now Delaware. From that time until 1664, the Dutch relied more and more on slavery to build up their colony and make it more profitable. Initially, they brought slaves of African descent from their colony in Brazil. These slaves were not owned by individual plantation owners. They were leased from the Dutch West Indies Company. That is, until the English pressed their claim to the territory and New Sweden became the colony of Delaware. Then the landed gentry had to buy their own labor. In Maryland and Virginia, slavery began with white indentured servants. Landowners in these colonies quickly began using African slaves because they could be held for life. The aristocracy feared being overpowered by a growing population of poor peasants freed from bondage after finishing their servitude contracts. From the 1680s through to the Civil War era, the colonies and then the states enacted a variety of legislation to regulate slave trade and restrict the lives and status of enslaved people. Though a few of the laws were written on the pretext of providing slaves with humane treatment, they were essentially for the purpose of protecting their owners. Eventually, the Revolutionary War and the resulting democracy began to inspire anti-slavery sentiments. Warner Mifflin was an early American legislator from Delaware who petitioned the U.S. Congress to have slavery made illegal in the new Constitution. Though he was not successful, he was part of a growing chorus of advocates for the abolition of slavery in the new country. At that time, the Quakers and then the Methodists began a concerted effort to get all their members to free their slaves. Then they turned to their neighbors. Abolitionist societies began organizing. They published pamphlets, held public meetings, and the more talented orators among them traveled a circuit of small and large gatherings to give speeches and raise money for the cause. This outreach began to have an effect, and the practice of slavery began a slow decline. Landowners on Delmarva at that time were also switching from tobacco to grains as their primary cash crops. These required fewer people to grow and harvest than the labor-intensive tobacco crops, which were failing on Delmarva in part because it was so hard on the mostly sandy soil here. Freeing slaves was a way to reduce overhead and be more socially acceptable. In Delaware, the legislature now had a number of members who were ardent abolitionists. They saw to it that laws were enacted to prevent the sale of slaves out of state, particularly to the Deep South, where demand for slave labor was continuing to grow. If you've just joined us, this is the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and this is a story about slavery on Delmarva. Lawmakers went back and forth for decades, enacting pro- and anti-slavery laws. Slave owners in Delaware were forced to pay £60 for each slave they set free, and that amount doubled a few years later. By 1697, Delaware legislators had effectively ended the sale of slaves in their state, unfortunately without making the holding of slaves illegal. Then the bloody 1831 Nat Turner Rebellion in Virginia stoked fears of a slave insurrection leading to more laws restricting enslaved and free blacks across the country. Meanwhile, abolitionists on Delmarva did not confine themselves to just legislative remedies for bringing an end to slavery. They had a covert strategy as well, the Underground Railroad. The Quaker meeting in Camden, just south of Dover, Delaware, was a well-known stopping place for fleeing slaves, as was the Quaker meeting house in Odessa. Wilmington served as a sort of Grand Central Station, with abolitionist Thomas Garrett serving as station master. There are just a few private homes on the peninsula that are known to have been way stations. There is also evidence that barren stretches of beach on Assateague and Chincoteague also served as rendezvous points for runaway slaves to meet boats that carried them to freedom. There were many whites and blacks, like Harriet Tubman, on Delmarva who assisted the fugitives. This work was done with great secrecy, so the names of most of these heroic people remains a mystery. We really only know about those who got caught. Arthur Leverton of Dorchester County was stopped while helping a family of six slaves. The parents were sold south, and the children were returned to their owners. Leverton was told to leave the county or he would be lynched. There were cases of other whites who were actually tarred, feathered, and run out of town on a rail for assisting runaways. These were not sentences carried out with any due process by a proper court. As we all know, the Civil War brought about an end to legal slavery in the United States. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 actually only freed slaves in the states that had seceded, like Virginia. After the war, the 13th Amendment was passed abolishing slavery except for convicted criminals. It took until December 6, 1865, for Georgia to become the last state needed to ratify it. Maryland is credited as one of the states who did not wait to fully emancipate their slaves. On November 1, 1864, a new constitution was adopted in the state, making it one of the first in the country to officially abolish slavery through a popular vote. Delaware, sadly, was one of the last states to make slavery illegal, and it only did so because the 13th Amendment became a federal mandate. Not all slaveholders willingly gave up their slaves in response to the new law. During the Reconstruction era, freedmen bureaus were established in most states by the federal government to give slaves a legal process to force owners to release them and to provide support for those who were turned out with no place to go. Slavery simply changed names in many places, including here on Delmarva. Landowners began employing slaves as sharecroppers or tenant farmers at very low wages and instituted monopolistic banks and stores that prevented former slaves from attaining full autonomy. Jim Crow laws in most states restricted their rights until their repeal through civil rights laws of the 1960s. It wasn't until 2007 that the Virginia legislature formally apologized for the state sanction of the institution of slavery. They were followed that same year by the state of Maryland. In 2008, the United States House of Representatives apologized, as did the U.S. Senate in 2009. And on February 11, 2016, just this year, Delaware finally did so as well. Most of the story of slavery is taught in our school books, but the stain of state-sanctioned slavery has not yet been washed out of our culture. It's important to acknowledge our heritage as both oppressors and oppressed, and how that still informs our behavior today. The history lesson here is that it takes a lot of people working together in and out of government to bring about change. And in the case of slavery, elections had consequences. They still do today, so be sure and vote in November. Find out more about this topic on our website, DelmarvaAlmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On October 15, 1928, a rare but mild earthquake was recorded with its epicenter near Ocean City. And on October 17, 1886, the Great Salisbury Fire began at Toad Vine's livery stable on Dock Street, which is now Market Street. 22 acres and 200 buildings in the center of town were burned to the ground. It's time for a break now. When we come back, we'll hear a conversation about box turtles. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. We're so glad you joined us. Now here's naturalist Dave Wilson with a conversation about box turtles.
My guest today is Scott Smith. Scott has worked for the Maryland Department of Natural Resources for 26 years and is a wildlife ecologist for DNR's Natural Heritage Program. Scott currently conducts applied research and conservation efforts for reptiles and amphibians. He has a bachelor's degree in natural resources from the University of Rhode Island and a master's in wildlife management from Frostburg State University. He lives on the Eastern Shore in Caroline County. Today, we're going to discuss a little bit about the lives and status of box turtles on Delmarva. Scott, I want to start with the basics here. What is a box turtle, and how is it different from other turtles?
Well, first, Dave, I'd like to thank you for having me here. The box turtle is called a box turtle because its body is kind of like a box. It has this high dome shell, and basically it's a box with legs, a long neck, and a tail. It has a bottom shell, which we call the plastron, that is hinged, so it's able to close up its shell really, really tight, like closing up a box really, really tight when it's threatened by any type of predator. This is our only truly terrestrial turtle in Maryland, one of the 19 turtle species we have, and it spends the majority of its time on land, whereas all the other turtles spend the majority of their time in water. It has an interestingly colored shell. It's very cryptically colored to fit in with the forest habitats it lives in. It's a mixture of yellows and oranges and reds and greens and browns and blacks. If you think about light coming into a closed canopy forest through little gaps in the trees and in the leaves, and that sunlight hits the ground in a little dot pattern, that's kind of what their shell is designed to help them hide in that type of habitat.
Can you tell me a little bit about what turtles eat or maybe some of the habitat requirements they have as well?
So we think of the box turtle as a turtle of open woodlands and fields. It depends on the time of year and where they are in their life, what habitat they use. And so they would overwinter in the ground, actually underneath the forest litter, underneath the leaf litter and the duff in a forest floor. And then they'd come out in the spring, feed on things like mushrooms or fungi. And really, they're an opportunistic feeder. They'll feed on pretty much anything that's around, whether they're berries, fruits, nuts, seeds, insects, insect larvae, even small mammals, and particularly baby small mammals, and frogs and salamanders, and even a dead fish or two. So they'll feed on some carrion. But they use the forested areas and also forest pasture field ecotones, these edge habitats, because they need that open sun, and also they lay their eggs in those open areas, whether they're someone's suburban backyard, a pasture, a hay field, an old field. So all those habitats are important, and they cover a pretty good ground. They have a home range of about 40 acres per turtle.
How old do box turtles get?
Well, surprisingly, there's one published account of a turtle getting to be 138 years old, which is really phenomenal. Probably it's more realistic that they'd get 50 to 80 years old. And Lucille Stickle, who's kind of a famous person in the box turtle world, she worked here in Maryland at the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center over in Laurel in Prince George's County. And she did a famous study that started back in the 60s. And that study has since been carried on by folks who followed up on her work. So there's an over 50-year study on box turtles there. And they found that actually the majority of the box turtles in a population only live 25 to 35 years. And it's just those rare old-timers who make it somewhere between 50 and 80 years.
What are some of the threats that they face?
Well, like most other wildlife, one of the big threats they face is habitat destruction and habitat fragmentation. The fragmentation, particularly by roads. There's also illegal commercial collection for the pet trade in this species. There is an increasing threat from disease, which I'll talk about again in a minute. Road mortality is very big. Even forest fires in some areas can cause real problems, as well as contaminants and even climate change.
Do you have a sense of the status of box turtles in Maryland?
Well, the work done at Patuxent National Wildlife Research Center is one of the longest data sets for box turtles anywhere, and it's shown that the population there has declined dramatically. We just finished here in Maryland our Maryland Amphibian and Reptile Atlas Project, which, of course, Dave, you were heavily involved with here in Worcester County. And that data is interesting. It shows that box turtles are still the most common turtle in Maryland as far as their distribution. They're found in every county in the state, and they're still everywhere. But there is a sense, and it's an anecdotal sense, that they've declined everywhere.
Can you talk a little bit about ranavirus? I know ranavirus, of course, has affected frogs, but it's affected turtles as well.
Yeah, really, there's three big species that ranavirus, which is a frog virus, has affected. Wood frogs and spotted salamanders, their larvae, and the one turtle that's really being impacted heavily by it is the eastern box turtle. In fact, it's really the one species that I have the most concern about because the frogs and salamanders are able to produce lots and lots of eggs. Box turtles really don't reproduce like that. They only lay one clutch a year, and it's not very many eggs. And predators get those most of those nests. So anything that's impacting adult box turtles is of concern. It's also possible that ranavirus has changed. It's a very rare virus because it started in fish, it jumped to amphibians, and then jumped to turtles, basically cold-blooded animals. We don't see that in most diseases. Most diseases are just in mammals or just in birds or just in fish. And so it's a very interesting and potentially deadly disease.
What can folks do to protect box turtles?
Well, first and foremost is to protect habitat. And by habitat, I mean large contiguous areas of forest and field. If a single turtle has a home range of over 40 acres and we have lots of overlapping home ranges, really the bigger the better, just some landscape conservation. On your own properties, or let's say you're out there walking somewhere, you see one, it's great to observe it, but just leave it alone. If it's in the wild, don't collect it. Leave it alone. And if you see one crossing a road, which is a source of a lot of mortality, if it's safe for you to pull over and help that turtle across the road, put it in the direction it's going and put it off the side of the road in the direction it was going, you can help it out a lot. You can also possibly in your own property, whether it's small or large, if you know you have box turtles there, you could think about leaving an edge along forest as unmowed habitat, at least through the summer into the fall. That gives them an area to catch insects, to feed, and to nest.
Thank you, Scott. We've been talking to Scott Smith, a wildlife ecologist for DNR's Natural Heritage Program. For more information on box turtles in Maryland, go to delmarvaalmanac.com/nature.
Thanks, Dave. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.